Today's Taisho will be on Case 14 in the Mumonkan. Case 14 is entitled Umon's Preaching Facing Oneness. Main subject: a monk asked Umon, "What is the teaching of the Buddha's lifetime?" Umon said, "Preaching facing oneness." Secho's verse, "Facing oneness, there is no parallel." He fitted the holeless hammer with a handle. From under the jambu tree, laughter rings out. "Ha ha ha! Last night the dragon got his horns broken. Remarkably, the old man of Shoyo, he has one tally here." Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. I know that some of you drove a long way to be here, and I hope you had a good experience. I hope you had a good sit. Regular practice is quite important. If you can make a half an hour of time during your day to do Zazen, that's very good. If you can make an hour, that's even better. Generally speaking, about 15 minutes are required for you to relax. So if you meditate for, say, 20 minutes a day, you're meditating 5 minutes a day. The first 15 minutes are probably just getting relaxed. And then probably in the last 10 or 15 minutes, you're able to do a little meditation. The relaxation experience is really beautiful. If you've had a tense day and you begin to relax, about 15 minutes in, you will feel much better, or you'll go to sleep. No, either way, it's okay. You know, after a while, you'll wake up and you'll feel much less anxiety, much more energy, probably. So, you know, half an hour of practice is good. That's a good goal. If you can do an hour, even better. That means more time beyond the basic relaxation response to explore the undivided mind of samadhi. And then it's very important to do additional sitting if you can. It's not always possible. We have many, many demands on our time and attention. But something like a Saturday sit is really a wonderful opportunity to deepen your practice. You know, we get up and we drive here. We struggle to find a parking place. And then we recite sutras, and after some tea we sit down and we do 3 periods of meditation. Then we have a break and we do 2 more. And that's really exquisite. Or you came at 9:30 and you did 2 periods of meditation, and now you're meditating while you're listening to the Taisho. And when you leave here, you will be in a deeper state of concentration than you could achieve on your own in half an hour or even in an hour. So this kind of extended sitting is really wonderful and crucial. And you'll notice that when your mind gets up, it's quite different from when you sat down. People don't know what Zen is about. You know, they read books about Zen and they have many ideas. And they come to sit and nothing much may happen to them. You know, you're watching your breath and, your thoughts are running like crazy through your head. And it's very frustrating, really. I was talking to a beginner about this on Tuesday night. And the person is quite determined, is quite sincere in his practice, but he just said, I sit down on the cushion and I just start fighting with my thoughts. And I talked a little bit about trying to get back to the breath, not worrying too much about getting rid of your thoughts, just returning to the breath. And I said, if you just keep doing this, sooner or later you'll enter a state where The thoughts don't completely disappear, but they recede a little bit to one side. And you will be able to focus on the breath a little bit more, a little bit more. You know, when we begin sitting, we start to notice all of this mental activity. And this never stops. You know, every time we sit down on the cushion, you'll probably become aware of just how crazy your mind is. You know, how much this torrent of thought, like a stream, mountain stream. You know, just thoughts rushing onward. And it's right under the surface. You know, I'm always surprised by how naive people can be about their minds, you know. Many people really do believe that they're rational beings, you know, that they go through their day making rational choices and evaluating options. This is sort of an economics view, and also a philosopher's view, very much so. If you read philosophy from the Enlightenment, you would never guess people had unconscious minds or subconscious minds. It's all about reason. So they really do imagine a person going through the day just thinking, making rational choices, evaluating options, and making the best choice. This is real. This is part of the mind. It's not a fake. There is a dimension of the mind that is really like this, and it can be trained and cultivated and can do amazing things. But on the other hand, right under the surface of the mind, there's this, it's like a torrent of thought. It's almost like insane, right? One might almost say, you know, right under the surface of this rational being who is very self-possessed and who is always at the center of everything and making decisions, there's this torrent of thought and emotions that come along with it. And when we sit down on the cushion, we suddenly fall from one level to the next, or drop from one level to the next. And we're on the surface of the mind where it all seems to be reasonable. You observe the world, you make notes, and so on. And then you meditate, you watch the breath a little bit, and you drop under the surface of the mind, and you suddenly realize there's this torrent of thought. And you realize that we're, you know, right under the surface of our minds, there's this all this stuff going on. And in fact, you know, it colors our experience of the world in our more rational self, you know. It deeply influences us all the time, even though we're not aware of it. So, you know, when people sit down on the cushion and they suddenly become aware of all their thoughts and their mental activity, they might feel like this is a failure. But it's not. You've already achieved a great deal. You already have more insight into the way the mind works than people did a couple hundred years ago, anyway. And you have more insight than most people ever do. You know, most people don't understand how consciousness works. But right under the surface of that ego who makes decisions in a rational way and makes cost-benefit evaluations, there's this torrent of thought. And it's not rational at all. It's flowing along in these chains of associations, and things are coming out of the unconscious and into semi-consciousness and dropping back into the unconscious, and they're triggering all these reactions and emotions of which we're hardly aware. So, you know, basically, the classic example is that you go to work and your boss gives you a hard time, and you come home and you yell at your kids or you yell at your dog, and then later you think, why did I do that? That was totally irrational. You know, why did I yell at my child? You know, she didn't do anything wrong, but an irrational thing to do. You could try to say, I'll be a more rational person next time, but really that's a naive view. Under the surface, there are all these motivations which are almost unconscious, and they're pushing our buttons all the time. You know, so when we're at work and we're in a hostile environment, and then we come home and we yell at our child or we yell at our dog, we're really yelling at our boss, you know, but we can't do that. And unconsciously there's this anger festering under there. You know, so just being aware of your thoughts under the surface of your mind is really quite an achievement. And a lot can be learned simply from watching your own mental activity, you know. So, you know, you're sitting on the cushion and you're watching the breath and you're trying to keep your mind focused on the breath, but you become aware of this, of you know, maybe you realize something's really bothering you, or you become aware of some kind of patterns of, you know, mental activity. So, you know, basically, you know, there's a kind of, maybe you have a kind of pessimistic turn of mind, or maybe you're a little bit anxious, and, you know, you tend to be the kind of person who always imagines that the worst thing will happen. You know, those are like mental habits you can become aware of when you look at your mental activity, you know. And I think these are quite long-lasting. You know, for the last 3 days, my sister and her husband and her two sons have been staying at my house with Barbara, my wife. And the older boy is very much now afraid of the dark and afraid of ghosts. And last night we were all sitting in the living room talking, and we have old-fashioned lights on the wall. They're called sconces, and they have a little electric, like a candle, like a little electric bulb that looks like a candle, and they're about 25 watts or something, and they project onto the ceiling sort of oddly fragmented light. And we were talking about something, and out of the blue, the boy who has some problems being afraid of ghosts, he says, "Do you see a skull in those up above the lights?" You know, and we all looked, and of course, naturally, we didn't go, "Oh my God, yes, a skull!" You know, we said, "No, it looks like a puppy dog." You know, it looks like, you know, anyway, it's just light. You know, it's not a skull. You know, but he sees skulls everywhere. Well, there's a lot going on there. I think his mother is a very good mother and loves him very much, and his father's very kind and generous. So, you know, but that there's something about his relationship with the world and about his relationship with the unconscious which is already coming out. So, you know, he's walking around watching television and listening to the adults talk about some boring subject, and thinking about when are they going to serve the pie and the ice cream, which he asked about several times. But then when he looks up at the ceiling and his mind starts to drift, he sees skulls, you know. So humans are very interesting creatures, I think. But sometimes when you sit on the cushion, you know, you can see your own skulls. You know, you can see what's going on under the surface a little bit. Takes a while, but you can do that. So please don't think that when you are sitting on the cushion and you're just having thoughts, you're failing at Zen. Please become aware of your thoughts. You know, if you have a little distance on them, that's good. And at some point, you might try to notice where your thoughts are coming from. And that doesn't mean what ideas are inspiring your thoughts, but try to watch a thought emerge from your mind. That's very difficult, but please give it a try. You know, try to see a thought arising in your mind and try to watch it as it goes away. Watching a thought arise in your mind requires great concentration, so it's not an easy practice. But there's actually, in Chinese, there's actually a word for that. It's called wato. Wato means head of the thought. In later Zen, that was a common meditation practice. Was not to try to rid the mind of thoughts, but to try to follow the thoughts backward to their root, the root of the thought. So, you know, basically you see a thought in your mind and you can watch it fade away, and then you can watch the next thought arise. And in this way, you will enter a deep state of concentration. So that's called wato. And even if you can't do the Watto, just noticing your thoughts, seeing how they're coming one after another, and noticing maybe patterns in your thoughts is a really substantial achievement and gives you a kind of advantage over your former self, in my opinion, because, you know, normally people have thoughts and there's no space between themselves and their thoughts. They are their thoughts. And those thoughts usually trigger emotions, and we feel we are those emotions. After my nephew, whose name is Tyler, saw skulls in the lights above the sconces, we all started talking about being afraid as children. And my wife talked about how she used to have to walk home sometimes by a graveyard. This is like a classic in Albuquerque. And she said she realized that if she began to speed up her pace, she got more afraid. And she said if she ran, she was done for. She was terrified, right? The humans are really interesting, right? It's nothing like the rational person, right? I mean, this is so interesting. Another person, my sister, I didn't know about this, but she used to have to go in our house when she had to go to the bathroom at night. She would ask my brother to stand at the end of the hall while she walked down the hall and went into the bathroom. It was just too frightening to go into the bathroom by herself. And she'd say, "Peter, are you still there? Are you still there?" And sometimes my brother was not always a nice guy. He was kind of a trickster. Sometimes he wouldn't answer, and she'd become terrified and run back, you know. We started talking about this, and I thought it was interesting. My wife said, "You know, when you start taking your fear seriously, it becomes even more gripping, really, you know." So she had to walk by this graveyard, and if she happened to do it at night by herself, she would begin to feel afraid. And then if she started speeding up her pace or acting like the fear was justified, it would feel even more intense. And then if she broke into a run, she would be terrified, right? I mean, she knew there were no ghosts with her rational mind, but underneath there's something going on, right? And the interesting thing is that we can be like that too, you know. We can be caught up in our thoughts totally and obsessively, and they can be triggering these emotions which are very hard to get rid of. But, if we can, you know, one of the practices of meditation is learning how to put a little space between yourself and your thoughts. You don't necessarily get angry, but you see your anger arising. You know, people have actually come up to me and said, "You know, I saw my anger arising today, and I just feel like giving them a giant hug," because that's such an achievement. You know, everybody talks about enlightenment, but being able to create a space between yourself and your thoughts is a major achievement. And what it allows you to do is not to be captive by the captive of your thoughts. You know, You can see your thoughts arising. You can see the emotions, but there's a space. There's a little distance. And sometimes you can choose not to go down that road, you know. A lot of meditation practice, at least in the early stages, is learning how to say no to thoughts. So, you know, when you're watching your breath and thoughts start to arise, you don't have to allow them to go, you don't have to allow them to proliferate. In Chinese Buddhism, thoughts were often called creepers, like vines, like ivy vines or sweet potato vines. And if you've ever seen a time-lapse photograph of, say, vines growing, you know, there's a little sprout, and then all of a sudden they start proliferating until they cover everything. Well, thoughts are just like that. And if you have mental discipline, you can use your breath perception to prevent your thoughts from proliferating in that way. So you watch your breath, and the breath goes out, 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 and usually if you're really intensely focused on your breath, there's no room for thoughts to take root. When you run out of breath and your concentration ceases, thoughts begin to spring up right away. But if you're quick about it, you can go to the next breath, and you can sort of like cut off the creepers, as they used to say, and prevent them from proliferating. If you can do this for a little while, you'll suddenly notice that your mind feels very empty. The practice of Wato is another way of not being swept up by thoughts, so that as you're having a thought, instead of following the thought, you try to look at the root of the thought. You try to go to that dark place where the thought, from which the thought emerged. And of course, if you keep going back to that place, you begin to enter deep samadhi. Samadhi is often experienced as this sense of being in something, or firmness, or stability. Sometimes it can feel, for me, samadhi sometimes feels like when I was a boy, I used to go to the pool on the military base where I lived. And there was a diving board, and the diving pool was 18 feet deep. And I used to like to go into the water, to dive into the water, and go try to get to the bottom. And when you got very far down into the bottom, the pressure of the water was quite palpable. So you could really like feel the pressure of the water on you. And sometimes when I'm in samadhi, that's how it feels. I feel like I'm in the bottom of that pool. But other people experience samadhi differently. They feel like they're floating, or they feel like they're 10 feet tall, or you shouldn't strive for these experiences, but if you are not being captive by your thoughts, and you can create a little space, and as that space grows or opens up, you'll begin to notice that you begin to enter a samadhi state. And today we did meditation again, outside, walking meditation, and it was quite beautiful. I had really concentrated very hard in the last two sits, and I was really working hard to cut the thoughts. And when I got up, my mind felt very clean. I can remember during the second sit, where I finally started entering samadhi, deep samadhi, and I could just feel it. I had that feeling of being underwater, or my teacher used to feel like he was a stick of incense, and he was disappearing from the top of his head all the way down. So he felt it a little differently. But it can be very subtle. Maybe you just feel a certain lightness or a certain heaviness. But at any rate, I knew I had gone into deep samadhi after about the middle of the fifth sit this morning. And then when we went out, it was just glorious because, I was able to watch the world, the beautiful trees and the bees and the grass and things like that, without a lot of thoughts obstructing my view. And I find that should be just glorious. That's like going home. It's the most beautiful feeling of real connectedness, peace, contentment, and safety and well-being. All of these feelings are sort of wrapped up. And it's really a beautiful state. I was asked to lead meditation last week at a Poson festival for the Sri Lankan community here in New Jersey. And we don't really practice Vesak and Poson, but these are in South Asia and much of the Theravada world. These are big deals. These are big holidays like Christmas. And there's a birthday and Enlightenment Day. Vesak is traditionally Enlightenment Day. Poson is traditionally birthday of Buddha. And the Sri Lankan community asked me to come and lead meditation. And I used to be very involved with the Sri Lankan community a long time ago. They were a very vibrant community. I used to be invited to their events, and they were quite a large community. Maybe 100 people would show up at some of these things, 80 people. And, there were monks would come and recite the sutras, and then I would lead a meditation. They went through a very difficult time. Apparently, they had sort of like an internal conflict. Their community had bought some property on Route 27. Some of you may have seen it. There's a Buddhist temple on Route 27, a Sri Lankan temple, and if you drive by, you'll notice there's a giant Buddha in the backyard. It's kind of hard to miss. It's quite beautiful. Whoever did it, they brought an artist from Sri Lanka, and he did a giant seated Buddha. And they bought quite a bit of property back there, and their plan is to develop that into a temple. But, as so often is the case in communities of any kind, you know, they had a split in their community. And they disagreed about many things, including this development of this property. And so one group stayed with the property, and the monk who is in charge of that site. And the other group went off on their own, and they just practiced Buddhism without any spiritual teacher, without any... And they basically have done a wonderful job. It's really remarkable. And their community has grown. And so they have not really made meditation a big part of their practice. They sort of practice reading the scriptures, the sutras, and they try to follow the Buddha's ethical teachings. And they have a beautiful spirit. It's really quite wonderful. And they have Dhamma school for the kids, like a Buddhist school. And they study Buddhist morality and principles of Buddhism. But the little bit their community is missing, really like a core, I would say, the meditation practice. And so they invited me to do a 2.5 hours talk, and then meditation, seated meditation. And a lot of them don't practice, so it was quite difficult for them. And they were like beginners at so many places. When they came in, a lot of people saw the cushions on the floor, and they took the cushions and moved them to the back of the room and put them against the wall so they could lean their backs against the wall. And I explained that that was okay if they wanted to do that, but it would be better to sit properly. So I showed everybody how to sit. And then I gave a little talk on Zen practice and meditation, Buddhist meditation in general. And I talked about, I actually read some Pali Sutra material that was quite beautiful. You know, the Buddha, it was one of the sutras where the Buddha describes waking up. And he says, you know, I engaged for a while in severe austerities. It's in the sutra he's talking about his waking up, and he said, I engaged in severe austerities and I nearly died. And he said, he was eating like a grain of rice a day or something like that. And he was, his rib cage became like the rafters of a building. You could see his ribs, and he was like a skeleton. But he said, it didn't get me any closer to enlightenment. All of these austerities and self-denials didn't focus me at all. They didn't help. And he said, I was sitting there miserable, and he said, suddenly it occurred to me. I said to myself, this is the Buddha. He said, why have I not trusted that joy which is entirely wholesome? And he means the joy of meditation practice, right? That practice can be joyous. And the Buddha said, I've been making myself miserable on my quest for enlightenment. Why have I been doing that? You know, why have I been starving myself to death? I have been withholding from myself the pleasure of samadhi, of meditation practice. And so then he decided that he was not going to do that anymore, and he met a wonderful young peasant woman who gave him some rice and some milk, and he ate these, And he went back to do meditation with a full stomach. And then he ascended through the various, or descended through the various forms of meditation practice. And the first form is the form you encounter. It's called the different levels of meditation the term the Buddha used was jhana, which means the concentration, state of concentration, J-H-A-N-A. And by the way, Zen is related to that word, jhana. Okay. So anyway, the first stage of meditation, the Buddha said, is where you are no longer captive by your thoughts, right? But you can sit with a mind that's stable and focused and see the thoughts coming and going. And when you are in that state, you're usually less agitated. When you can create a space between yourself and your thoughts, you usually feel more centered, more balanced, less agitated, and joy can arise in that state. And then he said, I continued to meditate and I entered the second state. And in this state, thoughts and emotional turbulence. And he goes through the four jhanas. And in the last state, the last jhana, the highest jhana, there is nothing at all. This is what we call mushin in Zen. Mushin. So the Buddha moves from a state where you are contemplating to a state where thought ceases. And then you enter a state where there's absolute emptiness, right? So there's four stages, but the last one is absolute emptiness. And in that stage, you know, you aren't enlightened yet. Entering mu is not enlightenment. The Buddha didn't have his enlightenment experience when he entered that state. He was in that state, and he noticed the morning star, and he had his great awakening experience. So the message of the sutra is something we believe in Zen too, that enlightenment, you have to be able to enter absolute emptiness, but then you turn your attention back to the realm of form. And moving from emptiness, Zen practice involves moving from form into emptiness, from ordinary consciousness into this absolutely empty mind. And then turning your attention back on the world of form again, back on sounds, sights, tastes, body sensations. In the Buddha's case, he noticed the morning star, and he had his great awakening experience, and turned the wheel of Dharma. So, you know, I talked about all of this, and I talked about how this is still the method that we use in Zen today, that we also believe in the jhanas. And that what we try to do in our practice is to enter emptiness and then turn our attention back into form. And if you do this enough, sooner or later people are going to have an experience like the Buddha's Great Awakening experience. So I finished my talk and then somebody raised a hand and he said something very interesting. He said, how is this useful? What good does any of this do? And he wasn't being skeptical. I think he was just being honest. He said, "What is the value of all of this? You know, in terms of our everyday lives." And I thought that was a wonderful question. You know, I thought, and the answer I gave him was, I said, "Well, you know, to a degree, people don't appreciate their everyday lives are deeply colored by their unconscious obstacles." You know, so if you, when I was young, I used to go, I lived in Baltimore for a while, and I used to have to go to a tough school. And, you know, basically, sometimes on my way to school, I would get beaten up. Really, it was just like a really tough neighborhood. If you didn't, it was kill or be killed or run. You know? So I was in the run group. Basically I would just try to sneak my way to school and not get beaten up, and I'd try to keep a low profile all day. But I had a lot of anxiety, as you might expect. Even little kids have a lot of anxiety. And I think, you know, I carried that anxiety long after the bullies were gone, you know. Maybe I carry it right now. So, you know, I said, we all have these obstacles that we're not aware of that can be very crippling to us in our lives. You know, so if, you know, if you had a parent who was emotionally withholding, you know, this can be hugely consequential. You know, you might not be able to have successful relationships with other people because you expect them to let you down. And so, you know, meditation practice at the very least can be like a kind of therapy where we become aware of our obstacles. And where we begin to see our destructive behaviors and change our patterns. And that's very important. But also, you know, I do feel that people are really driven in their lives by motives they don't understand. You know, at the end of the sit, we had some more questions, and then there was they gave prizes to all the kids who had gone through Dharma school for the year. And then we left. Everybody left, and I was going out, and I was putting all the cushions back in my car. And a number of people drove by, and they drove by in like very nice cars, you know. So a number of BMWs went by, and so on, you know. I think a Mercedes went by, you know. So I noticed that some very good cars drove by me, much better than my car. But I wondered, you know, what does it mean to buy a Mercedes? Or what does it mean to buy a BMW? Now, let me just say, years ago, I almost had the chance to buy a BMW. And I got in and I drove it, and it was the most wonderful driving experience I've ever had. You know, it was amazing. It was so smooth and pleasant. So I admit it's a great driving experience. I think BMW is an amazingly well-engineered car. But I don't think people buy a BMW just for the engineering or because it's such a good ride. Maybe they do. Maybe I'm wrong about that. So if you have a BMW, forgive me, okay? But I think BMWs are also saying something they're saying, of course, you know, I can afford a BMW. But they're also expressing some kind of a hope for happiness, right? I mean, isn't that it? It's like, I want to be happy. I want to be at ease in the world. I want to be at home in my life. And I think so much of what we do is driven by this desire to be happy, to be at ease, to be at peace with the world, to be at ease in our skins and our bodies, to be loved and to love. You know, all of this is tied up together. And I think it's a powerful unconscious motivation that we're constantly seeking to fulfill in all kinds of ways, you know, and I think it can lead to, I think you can buy a Mercedes. And you go home thinking, I'm in a Mercedes, I'm in a safe place, I'm in a good place, everything's good with the world loves me, you know, I love the world. If the world didn't love me, I wouldn't have a Mercedes. You know, I mean, I think nobody sits there and consciously thinks this. But I think so many of the things we do are motivated by this desire to be at home, to be connected, to be safe, that feeling of oneness. The koan calls it oneness, right? You get in your Mercedes and you drive down the road and you just feel like this world is all one. It's all whole. It's all fitting together. And you know, so there's nothing particularly wrong with owning a Mercedes if it gives you that feeling. And I think it often is that's the motive, maybe. But I often think that we do things that don't really give us that feeling, and so there's a kind of restlessness to our lives. You know, I think there's a kind of... I think all human beings are a little bit haunted, like my nephew. I mean, I think that all human beings are haunted by the unconscious. You know, it's just true. This is a little boy, he's 12 years old, and he looks up in the sky and he sees the skulls, and he feels fear. You know, it's welcome to the Homo sapien. You know, really, that's a Homo sapien. And so, you know, that's part of it. We're haunted by our unconscious obstacles. But we also have this incredibly powerful unconscious drive, I think, for being connected or being at home. And I think much of what humans do can be explained as an attempt to placate their demons and get to this place. And this is like what we're doing all the time. We're placating our demons and trying to get to this good place. And, you know, sometimes we just can't placate the demons. They get to be too much. And they prevent us from getting to that good place. And a lot of the times I think we don't get to that good place because we're pursuing it in the wrong ways, you know? So everybody is familiar with, you know, the problems of alcohol. You know, my father had a lot of demons, and he was always trying to placate his demons, and he was trying to get into that good place. And he, you know, he would come home at night and have a couple of martinis, and for a moment, you know, he would feel at home and at ease in the world. But, you know, he eventually developed quite a serious drinking problem. I don't know if you watch Mad Men, but I have just been watching it. I'm only up to season 2. I find it really a little bit depressing, but also fascinating. I feel like I'm watching an accident unfold. And all of these people, you know, they go into their offices and they drink all day long. And I feel that there's a kind of desperation to all these lives that are trying, you know, they're trying so hard to get something, that sense of oneness or wholeness, and they're going about it in ways that really just seem not to work for anybody, you know. Although I think probably Don Draper has moments when he feels like the king of the universe, you know. So anyway, a lot of what we do, I think, is really motivated by this desire to have this experience like deep samadhi. And I think that Zen is quite remarkable in its analysis of the human mind, because I think it sees quite clearly that we are driven in all these different ways by these unacknowledged compulsions, and that also we have this deep desire to be at home in the world. And the Zen is saying, really, if you want that experience, you have to work through some of your obstacles. That's definitely the case. But that you really need to learn how to enter a state in which the thinking process ceases, or is at rest. And you can experience things in their pure presence. That's thusness, tathagata. So if you can experience things in their tat-atta aspect, their thusness aspect, suddenly the world is whole and you're absolutely at home and at ease. And even if you've had just a little taste of this, you know what I mean. But, you know, sometimes I sit down on the cushion and I'm very tense and nervous, and I get off the cushion and I go outside and I just feel liberated, you know. And you probably wouldn't be here if you hadn't had a little taste of that. So, you know, the way to achieve oneness, finally, is not necessarily to own a BMW, or not necessarily to be the greatest ad man on Madison Avenue, although that would be nice if you want to do that, that's fine. But it's actually much less remote than people realize, you know. The achievement we're seeking is really much less remote and much less difficult, actually, than we realize. You know, it's really right here. And Zen is really, I would say, quite honest about things, you know. I mean, people spend their whole lives pursuing, I think, this experience of oneness or connectedness in the most destructive or quixotic ways that are, it's never going to work, right? It's never, I mean, for example, I was reading an article the other day about a guy who was an investor on Wall Street. And I think people who are like Wall Street investors are deeply, they have a powerful drive for safety and security and happiness. But they go through hell. I mean, this guy was describing his life, and it was like he was in agony of anxiety almost all the time. And he was finally, he said, many people just quit in their 50s because they can't, they're having, he said, their bodies break down. They have all these physical problems caused by stress-related physical disorders. And he said, you know, people get in and they want to make enough money to get out. And he said, it's just a matter of whether you can hold up or not. And he described a truly terrible life. It just sounded absolutely, where, you know, you can make massive mistakes, you know, and so on. And he said, you know, basically a lot of people, your body just breaks down. You begin to have, you know, nervous disorders, or you have these terrible psychosomatic problems, or you begin to have, heart ailments or other stress-related disorders, and you just have to quit before you're taken out, right? And it's just like the most improbable way to achieve happiness, right? It's like, this is actually like the worst possible idea. You're going to be miserable every day, but at the end of it, you're going to be at peace, right? It seems very unlikely to me. So, you know, I think there's something quite honest about the fact that actually what we're looking for is more accessible than we think. It takes a little bit of application and regular practice, and it's right here. It's not rarefied at all. It's not. It doesn't require you to get a PhD, although if you want to get a PhD, that's good. It doesn't require you to get up at 4:30 in the morning and check the DAX in Germany. You know, it just requires maybe a half an hour of sitting in the morning and half an hour at night and regular practice. And sooner or later, there's this wonderful oneness. And I think if people understood this better, you know, we would have a little saner society. You know, I was just talking to somebody who has just come back from Bhutan in the Himalayas. You know, the person was telling me that Bhutan is just like this wonderful, this person is an economist, as a matter of fact, and is doing research on gross national happiness, and had glowing things to say about Bhutan. This is he's a graduate student in economics. And he said really wonderful things about Bhutan. And, you know, one of the things he talked about was that they have a very simple, you know, traditionally, very simple lifestyle. You know, it's not complicated, and it's not, you know, a frenetic commodity-driven economy. It's more closer to almost sustainable economy. You know, and I think this comes from knowing that the sources of happiness are not so far away. You don't have to immolate yourself to be happy. You just have to do a little meditation. And it's true, we all have demons. You know, sometimes working through our demons is takes some time. We all have obstacles, you know. But, you know, probably after a couple hours of meditation, you definitely feel better. And if you've been to Sesshin, you've probably had these sits where you feel like it's paradise, you know. And I think if our society understood this, it'd be a healthier society. We're in a certain way, we imagine that things are much worse than they really are, and we make these heroic efforts that actually only make things even worse. When in fact, you know, things are not so bad. The human being is in fact like a machine for enlightenment, a machine for compassion. So, I think that's good. Umon's preaching facing oneness. A monk asked Master Cloudgate, what is the teaching of the Buddha's lifetime? Sounds very remote. You know, when I was talking to these Sri Lankan people and I described the four jhanas, that guy's question was just one of the questions where people seemed to think that enlightenment was this, oh my God, this incredibly unattainable state. It was like, oh, the four jhanas, everything disappears. You know, that's going to take lifetimes. You know, that would be so difficult. It's like, actually not. You know, even people who never meditate have experiences of emptiness once in a while. You know, where my mind just went blank. You know, people say that. It's not so remote. You know, and the other aspect of this is that, you know, in Mahayana Buddhism, we believe that people are fundamentally enlightened already. That is to say, you know, I'm sure you've noticed people who are incredibly kind and compassionate, and yet they don't meditate. I'm sure you've met such people. There are many people I've known who have no religion at all, and no form of practice, but they're very compassionate, kind people, and they seem very awake. And you can say, how did that happen? Well, it's because the human being is fundamentally enlightenment. All people everywhere are fundamentally Buddha, fundamentally enlightened awareness. We mess it up. You know, as we grow up, we have obstacles. We get beaten up on the way to school, and we become afraid of school. We get thrown over in our romantic relationship, and so that affects us, and so on. But, you know, basically, human beings are fundamentally Buddha. It's not remote. It's not difficult. You can make it remote. You can make it difficult. You can create a sense of impossibility. It's like climbing Mount Everest. But you just take it one step at a time, you know, and it's much simpler than people realize. By the way, I wonder if you heard the news that a 72-year-old woman just went up Mount Everest, a Japanese woman. I thought that was great. Shows you. Even Everest. You know. Okay. A monk asked Umon, what is the teaching of the Buddha's lifetime? Umon said, preaching facing oneness. When are you not facing oneness? You see, when are you not facing oneness? And that would be a good, you know, this koan is about that, right? You just say, facing oneness. And you begin to realize, wait, I'm always facing oneness. You know, I can't find any place that isn't oneness. So, I mean, I've given you the koan, or I've given you the answer to the koan. But that's okay, because the next koan is, this one is called Umon's Facing Oneness, and case 15 is Umon's No Facing Oneness. And the next one, he says, no, it's not facing oneness. So that's the one I can give you. A monk asked Umon, what is the teaching of the Buddha's lifetime? Umon said, preaching facing oneness, or just facing oneness. Secho's verse, facing oneness. Wow! There is no parallel. See, but it's always here. You know, we go to such great lengths, and it's already always here. You know, if you sit down on the cushion, every once in a while you enter a thoughtless state and you go outside and you realize it's here. It's been here all along. There's a writer I would not recommend to you, but he has a wonderful line. His name is Henry Miller. And he's not really a writer a Buddhist priest should recommend to anybody. Let me put it that way. Nevertheless, he said, I took so much suffering to realize I didn't have to suffer. I think that is wisdom, I think. Secho's verse, facing oneness, there is no parallel. He fitted the holeless hammer with a handle. In other words, like a hammerhead that has no hole in it. Now, there was never something missing to begin with. From under the jambu tree, laughter rings out, right? By the way, what is a jambu tree? In Buddhist cosmology, the whole universe is called Jambudvipa. Jambudvipa. That's the current universe that we exist within. And it's imagined as a giant tree. See, so the whole universe is like this living being, like a tree, like a single living being. And if you could step back from, you know, our BS, our bullshit, you could hear that the universe is really like ringing with laughter. That's really quite wonderful. From under the Jambudvipa tree, laughter rings out. Ha ha ha. Last night the dragon got his horns broken. So, you know, not such a scary place. Not too many ghosts, after all, right? Remarkable. The old man of Shoyo, he has one tally here. Old man of Shoyo is Umon himself. That's another name for his place of origin. So really, Umon is saying here, well, or Secho is saying, Umon really hit the nail on the head this time.